Thank you. Darkness realized, wrote Joseph Sittler of blessed memory, darkness realized is creative of a receptive theater for the drama of God's salvatory action in Christ. There is a dynamics of damnation, a process of perdition that may be used by the Spirit in such a way as to constitute of it a positive preparation for the gospel. Darkness realized. This statement of a wise and good man who was known to many of us here will function as a kind of text for my final meditation. With all classical and particularly Pauline and Reformation doctrine, this sentence of Joseph Sittler's recognizes and builds upon the strange and paradoxical, but not illogical, way in which the gospel of the crucified one incorporates the experience of negation into its resolution of the human dilemma. To come to the honest realization of that dilemma, the darkness, is already to have moved in the direction of its overcoming, the light. Light is not only given in the darkness. Darkness realized is already light. But Sittler's wise summation of this paradox also implies certain difficult questions, questions whose difficulty becomes particularly apparent within the context about which we have been asking here our own contemporary Sitz im Leben as North American Christians approaching the 21st century. Darkness realized may already in some imperfect yet sufficient way demonstrate the incipient presence of the light of truth, the truth of God, and therefore also the light of hope. But what of the darkness that is not realized, that is perhaps deliberately, perhaps desperately hidden, that is categorically denied, that is silently but effectively squelched before it is permitted to register itself at the conscious level? How does anyone, and how in particular do Christians, deal with such unrealized darkness? Why, to begin with, is it unrealized? And what makes it possible for human beings to move from the unrealized to the realized state? What might it mean for us, people of this allegedly new world, a people still courting a new world order in which we are preeminent? What does it mean for us to come to the realization of the darkness that is here in our own midst, and that is the more devastating because it is perennially denied? These questions suggest the structure of this address. First, I shall speak about darkness unrealized, its reality and its rationale. Secondly, I want to characterize the gospel as gracious permission to admit our darkness. And third, I shall try to suggest what kind of social stance or public stance or global ethic could emerge from the midst of a people that had made the transition from the repression of the truth of its real condition to the greater realization of that condition. And I'll presume to call that third consideration wisdom from the depths of the darkness. First, darkness unrealized. For almost 500 years, half a millennium, oppressed, marginalized, dissatisfied, and searching human beings from every part of the globe have looked to North America, particularly to Canada, the United States, as a place of refuge and new beginnings. Europeans particularly have equated the word America with liberty, equality of opportunity, respite from the drudgery and hopelessness of societies that are steeped in ancient rivalries and a way into the future. America, the land of unbegrenzten Möglichkeiten, of unlimited possibilities. During the past 3 or 4 decades, however, this conventional European assessment of America has been conspicuously altered. And one does not have to live for very long in Western or Eastern Europe to hear about the alteration. To the modern European, wrote Fritz Bury in the foreword of his 1968 book, Thinking Faith, to the modern European, America today seems no longer so much the land of unlimited possibilities as the land of unlimited problems. This sentiment is echoed by some within North America. We are waking now, wrote Gerard Peel. We are waking from the American dream to realize that it was a dream. Few Americans lived in their waking hours. The history of the New World has turned out to be not so different from that of the old. The peril that threatens the last of the American wilderness arises not from the reckless dream, but from the same historical forces of rapacity and cruelty that laid waste to the land in the Mediterranean basin, in Arabia, India, and the treeless uplands of China. Such an assessment of the state of our society is becoming less and less exceptional. Ecologists and environmentalists with Peel bemoan the rapaciousness of the consumer society, along with the waste, the lack of sensitivity to ecosystems, the apathy of the dominant culture concerning long-time future and the fate of the earth, to use Jonathan Schell's term. Sociologists and social psychologists detail the degradation, the crime, the poverty of our larger cities. Historians like Christopher Lash remind us of the discrepancy between our earlier great expectations and the diminishing expectations of the present. Above all, our most sensitive creative artists, especially novelists and playwrights, have for a much longer time than their more scientific colleagues been depicting a society frantic like a cat on a hot tin roof, Tennessee Williams, or filled with the internal contradictions of racial and economic classes, Sinclair Lewis, John Steinbeck, or behaving for all the world like empire whilst continuing to deploy the more modest rhetoric of the Republic, Gore Vidal's Empire, Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, and one could go on. Nor have theologians been silent. Before the critique of church and society, coming from the experience of black people in a white-dominated society, or from the experience of indigenous people newly conscious of their cultural and religious divergence from mainstream America and Canada, or from the experience of women. Before that, Reinhold Niebuhr, whom with George Lindbeck I regard as our most original contextual theologian, was writing paragraphs like the following. I quote, "The prosperity of America is legendary. Our standards of living are beyond the dreams of avarice of most of the world. We are a kind of paradise of domestic security and wealth. But we face the ironic situation that the same technical efficiency which provided our comforts has also placed us at the center of the tragic developments in world events. There are evidently limits to the achievements of science, and there are irresolvable contradictions both between prosperity and virtue and between happiness and the good life, which had not been anticipated in our philosophy. The discovery of these contradictions threatens our culture with despair. We find it difficult to accept the threats to our happiness with a serenity which transcends happiness and sorrow. We are also offended by the contumely of our allies as well as our foes, who refuse to regard our prosperity as fruit and proof of our virtue, but suggest that it may be the consequence of our vulgar philistinism. We are therefore confronted for the first time in our life with the question whether there is a simple coordination between virtue and prosperity, and whether the attainment of happiness, either through material prosperity or social peace, is a simple possibility for man, whatever may be his scientific and social achievements." End of quotation. In this statement that was written 40 years ago, Reinhold Niebuhr both summarized the findings of many of our most sensitive and concerned forebears and anticipated the variations on these same themes which have been advanced since his time by many others. "We find ourselves," he said 40 years ago, "a people threatened with despair." But must we not honestly add this caveat? Some amongst us sense incipient despair. Some of those who sense it have the necessary spiritual and intellectual tools to articulate it. And some of those who articulate it do so in such a way that it both opens the eyes of others to the truth of our condition and gives them a little courage to believe that our condition could be altered. But does it not still seem that those who are ready to realize our darkness constitute a minority? Is not the burden of truth orientation in this society still borne by a few, perhaps by a very small minority? Are we not on the whole still mouthing the litany of progress as though it were indubitably true and obvious? And if there is some reason to doubt our innocency and the superiority of our way of life, as there was in the 1960s, do we not still find ways of recovering wondrously our sense of being winners? How marvelously the Persian Gulf War worked in that respect, at least temporarily. And how marvelously, too, does the downfall of that other empire, the evil, or at least quite untrustworthy enemy empire, confirm our most fundamental assumptions about the rectitude of our nations, our own approach to government, our own economic system. Every news flash Every new piece of information about the breakup of the Soviet system conveys to millions of households on this continent one grand message. We were right all along. We have buried them, contrary to the shoe-banging rantings of Mr. Khrushchev. Darkness unrealized, truth refused, self-knowledge repressed may be the most dangerous phenomenon of human individual and societal existence. The Bible is full of this warning. Let him who stands beware lest he fall. Don't be presumptuous. All of our forebears were under the cloud, but none of them made it into the promised land. St. Paul, 1 Corinthians 9 and 10. King David's moral darkness, ostensibly unrealized by the king himself, was destroying the nation. And it was the painful prophetic responsibility to force that darkness into the light. You are the man. The almost deliberate refusal of self-knowledge on the part of that righteous Pharisee who prayed so arrogantly in the presence of the humble and honest publican, or of that hypothetical one of the Beatitudes of Jesus who does not see the beam in his own eye, or of the Apostle Peter whose way of naive filial devotion was the absolute antithesis of Jesus' way, the way of the cross. Such a refusal and repression of truth is never just an innocent matter affecting only those who engage in it. Always such behavior bodes ill for those round and about, for private lies always have public consequences. Our first world darkness, unrealized, though it may not materially affect those who are most successful in camouflaging it, has immediate and dire consequences for millions of third world peoples and hundreds of nations, and for the poor and oppressed within our own boundaries. Darkness unrealized, darkness hidden beneath the ersatz light of official optimism, darkness deeply repressed for the sake of carrying on business as usual, darkness advertising itself as light, this is finally the greatest darkness, the most cunning ploy of the Prince of Darkness. But it is also not without a rationale. If you ask yourself why, in your personal life, you habitually refuse to allow yourself to think about that, whatever that may be, you will know in your heart the reason why unrealized darkness has a rationale. You do not think about that because it would destroy you to permit that to rise too often and too unguardedly to the surface of your thought. There are limits, limits to the self-knowledge that we may permit ourselves to entertain. Every one of us has his or her limits, and so do peoples, nations, collectivities. If darkness is unrealized, if its unrealization is, so to speak, the very program, the hidden agenda of a people, it is because that people cannot endure trespassing beyond the limits to truth-telling that it has set for itself. And how are those limits determined? Quite simply, I think, by the fundamental system of meaning by which a people defines its self-understanding, its goals, its values. For us North Americans, as I've tried to show in these lectures, that system of meaning has been encapsulated in a dream so magnificent, so positive, so full of unlimited possibilities, that the extent to which we may entertain our impossibilities, our failures, is extraordinarily circumscribed. Rather than admit the thought of radical negation into our consciousness, most of us will gladly lie, cheat, or go to war. Or so long as it functions for us, we will go shopping. But as Paul Tillich of blessed memory put the matter succinctly, there is only one alternative to life with failure, and that is lifelessness without failure. Tillich. The human being and the human society that cannot confront failure, even when failure has become blatant, degenerates into lifelessness. A society has opted for lifelessness when it prefers comfort to truth, forgetfulness to memory, entertainment to art, the technical quick fix to depth of exposure to the great problems, and simplistic religion and quasi-religion to profound traditions of belief. Without even considering the gross and blatant forms of escapism at work in our society, eroticism, drugs, suicide, and so forth, without even considering the fact, for instance, that in my own country, $8 billion are required each year from the public purse for the rehabilitation and treatment of victims of drug and alcohol abuse. Without considering all that, but simply bearing in mind the daily round of the average citizen who in Canada, as I said yesterday, spends nine full years in front of the television screen, I feel a profound sense of foreboding for our society. And all the more so because I love it and I cherish the promise that it still holds. I think that we are sliding into lifelessness. Not to say, in that more biblical language, into death. And the slide can only accelerate unless we acquire somehow the courage to face what has gone wrong with us, to realize our darkness. Secondly, the gospel permission to admit our darkness. For persons who share with me that kind of foreboding, at whatever level of apprehension and comprehension, and who feel some sense of stewardship for the planet, there can only be one fundamental vocation: to contribute somehow, to the kind of conscientization that could help to bring about a renewal of truth and hope, genuine hope, not mere optimism, in our society. In the still relatively affluent parts of the globe, such a process of conscientization is, of course, extremely difficult. It's one thing to help the materially poor and oppressed, obviously oppressed, to acquire a new consciousness of their condition. And that has been the agenda of Paulo Freire and others of the third world context. It is something else to conscientize the non-poor. So long as the pursuit of happiness in whatever vulgarized forms can seem to work, few North Americans will be driven by the pursuit of hope, the pursuit of truth. For Christians, however, this indubitably human preference for comfort is constantly countered by the demanding gift of the truth orientation that is simply part and parcel of our discipleship. You, said Jesus to his little flock, you shall know the truth. And they thought that was fun, because they rushed, as we all do, to the second part of the sentence. It shall make you free. We like the idea of freedom. It's written, that statement, over the gates of dozens of universities on this continent. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. But the gift of freedom, real freedom, entails as its condition an unrelenting exposure to truth. Freedom for the vast majority of North Americans seems to mean doing whatever gives you pleasure, undeterred by any suggestion that your pleasure may be causally connected with others' pain. Freedom for Christians in North America must mean freedom from the need to escape into pleasure. Freedom for the liberation of those whose pain is all the greater because of our societal commitment to the pleasure principle. You Christians in North America there, you are singled out to know the truth that makes you free. You are going to be pursued by the living truth. To choose the truth is very hard. The human spirit, I think, will avoid that choice as long as it can. I've been trying for years. People will live in the twilight of half-truth or in the artificial light of downright fabrication and falsification unless they are given some reason to think that confronting reality, no matter how hard and dark it may seem, could bring about a better state. So the question to which serious Christians in our society must know themselves to be driven is this. Does the message that we have to profess, does this gospel provide any sort of foundation for truth orientation, for the realization of the darkness, and thus for the conscientization of this society? Is there in this faith that we profess anything like the wherewithal that people need if they're going to be able to expose themselves as North Americans to realities that they are habitually shoving under the proverbial carpet? If the limits that human beings set for their exposure to reality are determined by the worldviews, dreams, systems of meaning, creative illusions that they embrace, what is there in our Christian system of meaning that could offer people the permission to become honest? Ernest Becker, in my opinion, one of the unsung seers of our history, recent history, wisely recognized that people need a system of meaning. He called it, as I said earlier, a creative myth, a creative illusion. Without a vision, the people perish. But more wisely still, he understood that the test of all human visions is, and I quote, the courage to absorb into one's own being the maximum amount of non-being. Hans Küng said the same thing essentially when he wrote, coping with the negative side of life is the acid test of Christian and non-Christian humanisms. We must entertain visions of the possible that are not derived directly from our daily experience of the actual, as I said yesterday. But in weaving such conceptions of what could be, we must never lose touch with what is, and especially of what challenges and even contradicts our visions. Our quest is not for light instead of darkness, but for light in our darkness. Is the Christian gospel the good news of such light? Before we answer that, we North American Christians, whoever we are, must honestly take stock of Christianity as it actually functions in our society at large. Can we honestly claim for this Christianity that it is a force for truth orientation and not for easy comfort? That it is giving people the courage to absorb into their own being the maximum amount of non-being? That it is providing for our citizenry the spiritual wherewithal to confront their personal and societal negations? That it is helping to conscientize the non-poor, to make us all more aware of the consequences for the world's majority of our insistence upon the good life? I have no doubt that there are Christian persons and congregations and movements where it would be possible to answer those questions in a bold and joyful and affirmative way. But that this is normative Christianity in the United States and Canada today seems to me far from the case. On the contrary, whether liberal or conservative, whether free church or formal, it seems to me that most of what passes for Christianity in North America today is wholly committed to the maintenance of personal security and the assurance of well-being. It falls short, far short, I think, of anything that could respectably be called prophetic. Popular biblicism and pietism, as displayed on television, evangelism, so-called, has the name of requiring of its believers a religious and moral stance wholly discontinuous with the godless delights of this world. But if you unpackage it a little, you find nothing but a stained glass version of the values of Middle America. Mainline, or rather once mainline Christianity, continues to offer a diminishing number of somewhat more sophisticated Middle Americans and Canadians less blatantly religious variations on the same theme. At most, the darkness that we try to realize and expose tends to be a highly private affair. The little personal peccadilloes that we enact in our favorite dark places. We clergy are afraid, even when we feel it within ourselves, we are afraid to engage in anything like prophetic critiques of the dream, of our way of life. We can, of course, excuse ourselves or explain ourselves doctrinally, theologically. We can insist that, after all, the message we have been commissioned to proclaim is one of decisive victory over the darkness, that ours is a resurrection faith, please, a faith that has gone well beyond Good Friday's darkness at noon. That to dwell upon the darkness is to forget that we are living after Easter. Oh, I've heard this again and again. Yes, and in a society whose primary Christian influences come from the side of post-Reformation Calvinism, Pietism, and liberal Protestantism with a dash of conventional Catholic triumphalism, such an emphasis can seem entirely consistent with our ecclesiastical traditions. In a good deal of the Christianity of this continent, it is almost a sin, therefore, perhaps it's the only sin left, to devote too much thought to the darkness. By point three of the sermon, whatever negations have been entertained in points one and two must be thoroughly resolved. Banished. The congregation should leave the sanctuary affirmed and confirmed in its determination to think positively. Attention must be paid to the prayers, too. Who amongst us clergy would today be caught addressing the Almighty with the kinds of impertinences one finds in the Psalms of Israel? Not to mention Jesus' own extension of that Jewish mode of prayer, the lament, the protest in the face of dereliction. In the most popular liberal and conservative Protestant churches, an enormous outlay of professional energy is devoted to keeping the whole emphasis in the church school, the divine service, and all the activities of the congregation, keeping the whole emphasis upbeat. The Crystal Cathedral does not use the hymns of Passiontide, I'm told. They are too negative. O sacred head now wounded. Negative stuff, that. What I'm suggesting, to be perfectly blunt, is that far from offering North American people the opportunity to come out, if I may coin a phrase, to come out of their shells of increasingly forced optimism and happy-face middle Americanism. Far from doing that, Christian churches on our continent, for the most part, are simply reinforcing the general dominant cultural insistence that ours is, damn it, the best of all possible worlds, and that if there are problems, they have their sources elsewhere. That as far as we are concerned, we are okay. But meanwhile, there are many people in our midst who don't feel okay. They feel anxious or angry or lost. They feel lonely, depressed, future shocked. They don't know right from wrong. Will they drop from the 13th story window, or will they crawl back up? Their families haven't turned out the way the television ads and sitcoms show it. Their jobs, if they still have jobs, and in Montreal 20% of them don't, their jobs provide little or no sense of accomplishment. Their skepticism about public life, about government, schooling, business, is at an all-time high, as I said yesterday. And where can they talk about all that? Where can they let it come out? Where can they even allow it into their own private consciousness when they've got to show up each morning at the office in a clean shirt and tie and with a happy face, sipping the coffee? If they do not conform to the image of happy, contented human beings that still dominates our society and is shown in every television advertisement, most of them are going to find themselves friendless. And so they go about day after day with the same rote cheerfulness. Hi, how's it going? Fine. And on Sundays too, if they're amongst the decreasing numbers of those who go to churches, they will do the very same thing, only perhaps with a greater effort of the will. Because it's Sunday. Who wants to show up at the coffee hour after church without a smile on her face? Hi, how's it going? Fine. It's funny, but I have an enormous quarrel with this religion. I think that it may be the greatest perversion of Christianity ever invented, far worse than anything thought up by Marcion. You know? Jesus did not require of those who came to him that they should smile and say that they were fine. The gospel is not a law which insists, don't worry, be happy. The gospel is first of all the permission to be who you are. And if you are like most of us, you are first of all anxious and afraid. This anxiety, this fear, is just part of the human condition under the conditions of fallen existence. The basic anxiety, wrote Paul Tillich, the anxiety of finite being about the threat of non-being, cannot be eliminated. It belongs to existence itself. The beginning of anything worthy of the name salvation is the honest recognition of this aboriginal anxiety, darkness realized. The beginning of light is the realization of the darkness. The gospel of the cross permits, encourages, and even elicits and compels that realization. It's not the last word, but it is the first, and without the first, the last is not possible. Life begins as we pass through the valley of the shadow of this death. We may pass through that valley and without fearing ultimate evil, because we are not alone, we discover, as we realize the darkness, that it is inhabited. We are befriended by one who has entered the darkness more fully than we, who has penetrated to the very heart of darkness. That one will guide us, will carry us if need be, through the darkness. Thirdly, political wisdom from private depths, wisdom from the depths of the darkness. It has seemed to me that the Lutheran tradition has understood in a unique and spiritually imaginative way this strange cruciform logic that darkness realized is already light, that the gospel is first and again permission to confront and confess our fears, our failures, that only then may we know the grace that is light for this darkness. Perhaps I'm too romantic to look at the Lutheran tradition in that way. Perhaps I'm transferring to Lutheranism as a whole the wisdom that I found in the writings of that remarkable man, a very mixed up man, but remarkable, Martin Luther. Well, and Kierkegaard. And Tillich, why not? Very mixed up. And Susan de Dietrich. And Joseph Sittler. And. Nevertheless, whether or not Lutherans have consistently appropriated this, you are all the same heirs to a theological and spiritual tradition which is in touch with this more ancient wisdom of the tradition of Jerusalem, a tradition that understands something of the manner in which, as Elie Wiesel put it in the quotation I used yesterday, the best visions of humanity were born in the night. And in this respect, at least, the Lutheran heritage of theology and spirituality occupies, I think, a unique place in the spectrum of Christianity, especially as it has manifested itself in our so-called New World. Because of your tradition's recognition of the continuing warfare of the human soul, that we are simul justus et peccator, because of your tradition's refusal to separate justification and sanctification, because it did not embrace a resurrectionism that relegated Golgotha to the theological, ecclesiastical, and ethical past tense. Because it knew that, as a third world theologian recently put it, that the darkness is still there and still returns. For all these and many other reasons, Lutheranism has seldom, with a good conscience, been able to endorse triumphalistic forms of religion and piety of the sort that have flourished in this new world, because they were more amenable to the spirit of progress and idealism and success by which America has been inwardly impelled until now. But, and I hope that you will hear this in the constructive way that is intended, it has also seemed to me that Lutheranism in North America has failed, at least until very recently, to enter sufficiently into the public sphere to make in that sphere the sort of difference that it might have made given the unique and different theological and spiritual tradition to which I have been referring. There are reasons, of course, for that hesitancy to enter into the public sphere. Lutheranism, as a relatively strong numerical force on this continent, came rather late in time, comparatively. It was for the most part associated with ethnic and linguistic groupings which had their own reasons for keeping apart, partly because in the case of the Germanic elements particularly, they were not made very welcome in this century with its wars. And at a deeper level, I suspect there has always been in Lutheran circles a lingering suspicion that the story you have to tell, or the way you tell it about God and the world, is significantly different from the dominant worldview by which the two northern nations of this continent have been so consistently inspired. In consequence, it seems to me, you have hidden your light, light that is meant for dark times, under a bushel. The name of the bushel has been personal piety. Lutheranism has existed in North America for innumerable human beings as a frame of reference for their personal struggles with evil, death, and the demonic, and as communities of suffering and hope. And that comes very close to what the New Testament understands by koinonia, I think. But the people of God in biblical perspective, especially the perspective that comes from the Older Testament, have also a prophetic task, a mission that extends beyond, way beyond, the boundaries of the ecclesia, beyond the boundaries of the national and linguistic and class and racial groupings with which all of our Christian denominations are, of course, bound up. And today it seems to me there are conspicuous contextual reasons why the Lutheran churches in North America must more and more take the courage and find the imagination to do what many Lutheran individuals and smaller movements have done, namely purposely to branch out into the public sphere, to bring your tradition to bear upon the experience of your country, to tell your story as a story that is as applicable to corporate as to individual human life, to become more vocal and visible as a participant in what Martin Marty has wisely called the public church, bringing to the rest of us, whose messages on the whole have been all too compatible with the success story called America, the kind of sober realism and realistic hope that emanates from your tradition at its best. According to a recent sociological and theological study of American mainline religion by Wade Clark Roof and William McKinney, much of the future of Christianity in North America is dependent on what these authors identify as moderate Protestantism. They include in that category Methodists, Ecumenical Baptists, Disciples of Christ, and some of the Reformed churches, and Lutherans. And they challenge these groups at the end of their sociological study, these groups which, they note, are losing their ethnic distinctiveness, they challenge them to take hold of the disproportionate stake in the restoration of public faith, which they think moderate Protestantism possesses. And they write, I quote, "If a revived public church is indeed on the horizon, moderate Protestantism will play a key role in bringing it into being. This will require forms and qualities of leadership that have seldom been forthcoming from the Protestant middle. A revitalized ecumenicity and new, bold theological affirmations are critical as well, especially a theology that resonates with and gives meaning to the experience of Middle Americans." I do not know whether Roof and McKinney mean quite the same thing as I do when I speak about the content of that theology, but their statement, as far as it goes, seems to me entirely correct. One would then have, of course, to go on to say about that theology, a theology that resonates with and gives meaning to the experience of Middle Americans must not mean a mere repetition of the old American theology of bourgeois transcendence. It must not mean the production of more religious bravado and more political hype. It must not imply a renewal of national boasting and imperial posturing and sword rattling. It must not mean the abstractness of patriarchalism. Rather, it must offer a vantage point for the facing of the ironies and the flaws of our system, and not just snickering about the downfall of the other empire. It must allow us to entertain our collective and not only our personal failures. It must give us the courage not to be the biggest and the best and the fastest and the sleekest and the most beautiful, but to be modest neighbors to the nations and peoples that have fallen amongst thieves. It must help us to overcome our centuries-old habit of plundering the earth and reducing to things our fellow creatures, and teach us how to be God's stewards, not, please, managers. It must teach us how to love the world that God has not and will not abandon, and to suffer with Christ in and for this world. Dear friends, it has seemed to me that what Martin Luther named theology of the cross, Theologia Crucis, is the best, most usable past needful to such a theology and such an ethic. And I would like to challenge and encourage you, you who inherit that tradition more legitimately than I do, to make it more and more your own, to give it the contemporary currency that it needs if it is to engage 20th century and not 16th and not 19th century mindsets. And above all, go public with it. Holden Village has done so. Many of you have already begun to do so. Please do so more and more. Thank you.
Helping us to face that darkness and the challenge before us. As the applause indicates, we thank you. Now may I put a real schedule on you. We're going to give you 10 minutes. 5 to, we want to try to begin. So rush out, get your lunch, whatever. And 5 to, we're going to try to begin. Okay? Back here. Oh, speakers, the three speakers, photo session right outside here immediately.